5 minutes, certainly.
May it please the court, my name is Carlos Hutchinson. I represent the appellant, Latoya Jefferson, in this matter. The appellant respectfully requests that the court reverse her conviction based on the trial court's error related to the denial of a full cross-examination of the witnesses against her and on the sufficiency of the evidence. This case...
Counsel, I hate to interrupt you so early, but in reference to the cross-examination, is there a proffer? And if there's not a proffer, is this a line that we can consider in terms of for appellate purposes?
Well, the proffer was denied by the court. I attempted to proffer for the record, and it was denied by the court. The judge was of the opinion that the proffer, the cross-examination, the questions I was delving into didn't matter.
Could you point to the record where you did that to preserve it? Because under the, I believe it's the Hernandez case, there has to be a specific proffer in the record for us to be able to take advantage of the trial judge having an opportunity to rule on the matter and not taking advantage of that opportunity.
I believe it's the appendix 123 through 124. After noting our exception to the judge's instruction to move on, we attempted to state for the record the basis of the argument and were again instructed to move forward by the court.
But not the basis for the argument. What I'm asking is a more specific or discreet question. Is there anywhere where you attempted or proffered the expected line of testimony?
I did not, because I didn't know where the testimony would lead. And if I could further explain, the case is about my client didn't report an additional child, and they did a recalculation. So she was receiving benefits, and based on her not reporting, they did a recalculation. And in the recalculation, they didn't give her any of the typical standard discounts that they get for housing, for a number of kids, and so forth. I was attempting to elicit from the witness what the amount would have been had she gotten those standard discounts.
Well, actually, weren't you asking about the other job and whether that would have been considered and how that would have impacted her income? Wasn't that the line of questioning?
No, I was questioning about the calculation and how the income from the new job would have impacted the calculation.
Right, you were talking about standard deductions. The line of questions in terms of the cross-examination that were in relation to the Frito-Lay job and how that might have impacted had she reported. Is that not what you were attempting to elicit?
In a sense, yes, Your Honor. And it's a good compliment, but because they added the income from the Frito-Lay job, but when they added the income, they didn't give any of the standard discounts. And that's akin to an object being on sale and then saying, well, because you didn't report it, that sale price is not the value of the item. It's not the fair market value, which is the standard the court uses. If she had reported that income, the amount she would have been entitled to would have been one amount because she gets the standard deductions. It would have been amount A. She didn't report it and was receiving amount B. The calculation that the court used or that the witness was using was a totally different calculation, and that was a calculation based on the income with no standard discounts, which are all part of the policy.
But the point I think Judge Malvo is driving at, and what I'm also interested in, is that you had a theory for your cross-examination, no doubt, something that you were trying to get information to either mitigate or offset or reduce the nature of the charge.
Yes.
And there was an objection by the Commonwealth, and that objection was sustained, in other words, precluding you from asking those questions. What we're asking is that, was there anything in the record that says, Judge, I respect the court's ruling. For the record, I'd like to proffer that this is the question that I would have asked. This is the answer that I anticipated getting, and I would have asked this question. I would have also gotten this answer, and I just want the record to show that those were the things that I wanted to elicit, and that was the information that I was trying to achieve for purposes of protecting the record. And again, I know that it's tough when the judge sustains an objection to ask for the permission to proffer, but our cases seem to suggest that is indeed required.
Yes, sir. And as I recall, and as the record would reflect, I did ask to proffer exactly what it was judge said it was irrelevant and instructed me to move on. So I did not, in the record, indicate exactly, I believe I stated my question, but didn't state what I was attempting to elicit from the witness or what I expected. And there was some back and forth there, and I believe the judge, responded without a further objection from the Commonwealth, instructed me to move on if the issue wasn't relevant.
And I get it. Let's assume that we get to the main issue at bar here. And I have a hypothetical for you, because I think I understand your theory of the case is that she probably or could have been convicted of a misdemeanor. She shouldn't have been convicted of a felony, because if there was an offset of the things that she was entitled to, it would have taken it under the statutory threshold. Is that a fair way of stating your argument?
Yes.
Suppose we have a situation where a person is engaging in traditional larceny, and there's a price tag that's placed on there for $850, okay? And the item really costs $1,000, all right? And there's a price tag for $1,000. And the person goes in and they sort of change and manipulate the price tag and put on their $850. And they go to the register and they pay $850 for it. Should have paid $1,000, they changed the price tag. Is that a misdemeanor or a felony?
Well, that would be a misdemeanor, because it would be $150 below the fair market value. So she essentially got $150 from the store.
But the cases seem to suggest that that's probably a felony, because we look at the value of the item stolen as opposed to what the offset was. And that's why I asked the question.
And under those set of facts, I think it wouldn't be necessarily a stealing. She didn't steal the entire item because she paid $850, which is similar to the argument here. She was entitled to some benefits. The question is, what is the difference between what she was entitled to and what she in fact received? Now, if you say what she's entitled to and you include that additional income, you have to give these standard deductions, which is what our argument was, but we weren't allowed to get there.
Was the court's basis, though, that it wasn't a relevant line of questioning, that she wasn't entitled to the deduction because she didn't report it? And that was the crux of the offense. With these types of offense, the issue is whether, one, they've reported, and two, you know, how much they've usually gotten over an aggregate of a 6-month period that's over and above what they're entitled to.
Yes, and we admitted she didn't report it. She did not report it. So the question is, what was the amount? What was the difference in those two amounts? And I think that required us to delve into exactly what calculation they used. And in fact, when they come back at sentencing, they said, well, we had some mistakes in our calculation, and there's actually a different number.
Although they calculated it up.
Well, because she said we didn't include this, she would have got a deduction, but we didn't include something else that would have added to it. And so it's, you know, my client is on, you know, facing a felony charge, hadn't had any prior issues. It's very important, and I think it's you know, we have a duty to, and the Commonwealth has an obligation to present all the elements, and I think the standard that they have to meet is to afford felonies to show that amount was above the statutory limit. The statute says that it shall be a larceny. For the same actions that my client was accused of doing, there's another statute for those same actions that says that it'll be a class 1 misdemeanor. When the statute doesn't distinguish if it's a petty larceny or grand larceny, it just simply says larceny. And I imagine that the Commonwealth then has to show, if they say it's a felony, that it meets that amount.
But Wright versus Commonwealth, which is an older case, a 1954 case, says the Commonwealth must prove the value of the item stolen. And the value is not the offset of what might have been paid toward the item, but rather the intrinsic value of the item itself and the receipt of that value.
And in this case, we don't have an item per se. We don't have an item. We simply have amounts that were given. And that amount is being the amount she's entitled to is deducted from, which makes it a bit different from having a physical item that says this is the fair market value of this item. I presume the fair market value would be the amount that she's entitled to when you take in the deductions for the number of kids, the housing allowance, this and that. That would be the fair market value.
But counsel, aren't they really looking at it in terms of what the overage is, what the overpayment is?
What the overpayment is. In order to know what the overpayment is, you have to know what the base is, what she's entitled to. And that's where we couldn't get. So my inquiry was into Well, she did report it. What was she entitled to? What should it have been? What was the amount? And we couldn't get there because the court wouldn't allow that line of questioning.
But again, we do have a line of cases that say that even though a specific value cannot be assigned to something, we still look to the fair market value of that item. We had a catalytic converter case, and I came to find out that catalytic converters have no value because you can't put them in another car. They're useless. But a catalytic converter does indeed cost, I was told, $750. So it's a weird situation. I understand your point, but the bottom line is, I understand the law is that we focus on the value of the item, and what I'm sure Kamala's going to argue is that the value of the item was the money that she received and having the benefit of something that she was not entitled to.
I agree. She received an overpayment, but you have to have the base to determine how much. You have to have the base, and that's our sole argument on that issue. And we don't want to waive any of the other issues that we raised. But that value is the argument, the base. What was she entitled to? Had she included that in there? What was the amount that she was entitled to? So that you could determine how much overage she had been paid. And we weren't allowed to get there. The denial.
So unlike most Washington cases, the baseline isn't zero. The baseline is whatever she was entitled to and the amount that was taken over the amount that she was entitled to.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And we would say that that is similar to the fair market value, the amount she's entitled to, or the base amount and then the overage amount. And the difference between the two would be the amount that she wasn't entitled to, and therefore that would be determined whether it's a petty larceny or a grand larceny. Or a felony or a misdemeanor in this case. And the statutory scheme that they have here for these, and this crime could have been charged under a different statute.
But isn't that the Commonwealth's prerogative to choose which theory of crime they would like to follow?
It is, Your Honor. And the statutes are written in this particular case, simply says the larceny. It says if you violate these things, you don't report and you receive a benefit, it should be considered a larceny. Take that a step further and say, well, what type of larceny, whether it's grand larceny, whether it's a felony larceny or a misdemeanor larceny. And that gets us back to the, if you go there, then like I was saying, the separate statute says those same actions are a misdemeanor. So we don't know the intent of the General Assembly when they put that statute in the statutory.
How is that any different from the example of like an embezzlement versus a grand and a petty larceny? Embezzlement doesn't have any sort of denotation about a monetary value, but if somebody embezzles something that's $150, that's a misdemeanor embezzlement. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree.
So and how is that different from what we have here?
I don't think it's different at all. I think it's the exact same thing. We have to show what the difference is in the two amounts. The question is, what is the base amount? And therefore, and without knowing the base amount, we can't determine what the overpayment is. To simply assume and say, well, we know she didn't report, so there's an overpayment. And because she didn't report, you get none of the standard deductions.
No, I was just asking the question in relation to your argument about whether it's a felony versus a misdemeanor.
I agree with you. It's a larceny, and so you have to determine what type of larceny.
What if the Virginia state government, they're never going to do this, but what if the Virginia state government sent me an IRS refund check of $3,500, okay? And I was actually entitled to $3,200, but they sent me $3,500. And I went out and cashed $3,500, knowing that I knew I wasn't entitled to it. Is that a felony or a misdemeanor?
It would be a $300 overpayment. I think it would be a felony.
Okay, what if it was $199 overpayment?
And Virginia would be a misdemeanor.
Okay.
And that's where we are. But we know what you were entitled to, and which would have been the $3,300. And I think that's the crux of our argument. Without knowing what the base was, for example, if they sent to $3,500, but you were in fact only entitled to $2,500.
Then that's easy felony.
That's easy felony. But if it's unclear whether you're entitled to the $3,300 or $2,500, then that's a burden on the Commonwealth to say, well, this is what he was entitled to, therefore this is the overpayment. Simply saying he got it and he cashed it isn't sufficient to find you guilty of a felony. That's an element that they have to prove. That's our argument.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchison. You have used up all but 12 about 10 seconds of your time, but I'm going to give you another minute after Mr. Anderson concludes, because we did ask you a lot of questions.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Counsel's first argument, it may be simply an indication of the modest expertise I bring to welfare fraud cases. I'm still not sure I understand the exact nature of the argument. The assignment of error is that the trial court did not permit complete cross-examination of the fraud investigator witness, Ms. Hankins. So that the actually assignment of error uses the word to finish. And the first point I would make is this is not like counsel started to move to a new area and he asked one question and it's immediately cut off. If you look at pages 118 through 22 of the appendix, this was actually gone into to some degree. Beyond that, and beyond what the court has said about the failure to proffer, and the counsel's pretty much, as I understand, pretty much acknowledged, he certainly didn't proffer what the expected answer would be. In a way, I can understand why he didn't proffer because of the context. His hypotheticals concerned things that were the antithesis of what was charged in the indictment. The indictment was that she failed to report certain income and she received more compensation is not the right word, but monetary assistance than she would have if she properly reported the second job and the income. So the questions or on something that's the antithesis of the indictment, which is, well, suppose she had done what she was supposed to do and reported the second job and the income. To me, that is the equivalent. Suppose you had a charge that someone committed burglary in the nighttime and you wanted to cross-examine them. Well, what if it was in the daytime? Well, so what?
Mr. Anderson, I assume your position is that she wouldn't be entitled to a benefit of something she's not reporting.
Right. I mean, the evidence, which has certainly not been, as I understand it, not challenged, and I think the trial court pretty clearly credited, the testimony was quite clear from Ms. Hankins that you cannot get deductions on income that is not reported. You get deductions such as the earned income deduction, which I think is 20%, for a reported income. You don't get it if it's not reported. In this case, there's no question factually that she did report it. So there's no question that because she didn't, she got no benefits arising out of that fact in the calculation of what she was entitled to. I don't think there's any dispute about that.
In your view, what is, and I'm using a term that's outside of what we use, but what is the amount of controversy here? Is it the amount of money that she received as per the request for the benefit? Or is it the difference between the amount of money she received and the amount of money that she would have received had she not committed the illegal act?
I think it's the latter, Your Honor. The evidence was that she should have, and let me put aside the third issue, which I think plainly at worst is harmless error because it was an $18 difference. But there were two indictments here. The first one concerned March through September 2015. The second one concerns September 2015 through February 2016. The evidence, both from what the witnesses testified to and also the Commonwealth's Exhibit 9, was that as a result of her failure to report the second job and the income she got from it, she ended up in the first six-month period getting $1,882 more than if she had properly reported that job and the income. The second six-month period, for the same reason, she was overpaid $1,517. So in other words, she should have received
a little more than $3,300.
The court said she essentially got about half because of her, and there's no real dispute on appeal that she acted in a fraudulent manner. She had the second job, had it for more than a year, didn't report it, no real justification, or at least none that the court credited, for failure to report it. She got the income from that, and plainly as a result of those two actions, she got more money than she ever should have gotten, and the court, I think this is in the sufficiency issue, let's see. The court, in convicting, this is a bench trial, in convicting her, found as fact that on three occasions she'd not wrongly failed to report the job and the income from it, the second job, which, quote, makes a big difference. It would have reduced your benefits almost by half. You received $6,456 in benefits. You should have received only $3,057. So you received more than half. And then this is obviously more minor in its impact, but she also got fuel assistance that, for essentially the same reasons, she got a little bit more than $37 more than she warranted. But that was the finding of fact from the court, that it was basically about $3,400 more in this 1 year charge period that she got than she should have gotten. The hypothetical, I think the court's absolutely right. What does it prove? It's completely changing the nature of the charge. I think I started to say this, I can't remember, but suppose you had a charge of a burglary at night and said, well, what about if it was in the daytime? Or if the burglary was charged armed with a deadly weapon, said, well, what if they weren't armed with a deadly weapon? Well, you'd have a very different case and you have very different charges, but that's not what was charged. That was not what was litigated. Judge Austin talked about fair market value. I'm not sure how much that comes into play here. These are computer-generated figures. You have pre-existing criteria based on how many people in the household. In this case, you have the defendant, her boyfriend, and I think five dependents. Yeah, two of them had jobs. And they report their income, and based on that, these are completely objective, established manner of calculating what does that lead to financially. And in this case, she reported a certain set of affairs financially. She should have reported this contrary or different set of affairs financially. Because she reported this one, then the computer spewed out the figures. If she had reported it the way she was supposed to, it would have spewed out these figures. So it's, at least in terms of the numbers here, it's pretty cut and dry. You either get, based on your representation, you get a certain amount of money. And because she didn't properly represent those figures, she got about $3,400 more than she should have. On the sufficiency evidence case, I'm not entirely sure what the argument is. I think counsel suggested at one point, maybe on brief, that, well, the court could properly find she didn't report the job or the income, and that should have only been petty larceny. The statute itself merely says it's punishable at larceny. Unlike, say, sections 18.2-95 and 96, there's not a word in there about valuation. There's not a distinction between grand and petty larceny. In fact, the statute she cited actually supports our position. The 18.2-186.2 specifically said that crime was a class one misdemeanor. The very fact that the General Assembly did that there and didn't do it here, the implication is there's no equivalent limitation. I think it's interesting, the motion to strike, I think, presupposed that upon sufficient proof, a person would be guilty of grand larceny, because the whole argument was there's insufficient proof of the $200 figure. Well, if you only could be guilty of petty larceny, there's no reason to make that argument. So, on the first issue, I submit that the court did not abuse its discretion after putting an end to the cross-examination after several pages of transcript. I think its ruling was correct, that this was just basically what if, in a not probative manner, line of inquiry. The trial court found as fact that essentially the defendant received $3,400 more over a 12-month period than she should have based on her failure, her unjustified failure to report her second job or her second source of income. And finally, just again, very briefly, in this third issue about this recalculation, there was an indication in the Hankins testimony at trial that there was one slight glitch. She corrected that at sentencing, which there were two errors, one in favor of each. There was one housing expense that the computer missed, but which inured to her benefit, but also the child support for March 2015 that she got. They were virtually offset. It's an $18 difference. If there was ever a case that was obviously harmless error, at worst, this would be the issue. So for these reasons, I'd ask the court to affirm, unless there are any other questions.
No. Thank you, Mr. Murphy.
I appreciate counsel's argument, and I think it interesting. There's a pre-existing criteria. You plug the numbers in, and it says, gives all the, applies the criteria to it, says, this is what you're entitled to. Absolutely agree with that. She didn't report it, and the unreported income wasn't put back into the computer and ran through that process through the pre-existing criteria to say, had you reported, this is what you would have been entitled to. But since you didn't, this is the overpayment you got. That's not what happened either. That pre-existing criteria was there. They didn't run it through the computer. They simply did a additional calculation without any discounts, without any of the pre-existing criteria, and said because you didn't report, which we said she didn't report, whether it was material or not, we argued it at trial. But because she didn't report, that amount wasn't ran through the computer and pressed against that pre-existing criteria to say, this is what you were would have been entitled to had you reported. Based on your income, this is what you're entitled to, including all her income. This is what you're entitled to. That wasn't done. What was done is, they said, well, you didn't report, therefore, the pre-existing criteria doesn't count. And it's a larger, that's why the amount, the distinction was large based on their calculations. Simply tried to delve into that to say, well, the 20% discount for her income and the discount for the housing and this discount is what I was trying to delve into. And as I looked back over the transcript, the court was of the opinion that, you know, it's irrelevant. I understand what you're trying to argue. The allegation is she failed to report it, and we understand the allegation. And
Mr. Hutchinson, I'm sorry to cut you off, sir, but you've gotten almost 2 minutes of time, yes, sir, that you've used that you didn't have. But I think we understand your argument. I appreciate your argument. I think we understand both counsel's argument. Thank you very much, sir. We're going to come down and greet counsel. Thank